Hi, everyone. Thank you very much. I want to, unfortunately, I have to start with something mildly unpleasant this morning. As a result of some disrespectful and inappropriate behavior at the party on Tuesday night, we had to ask a number of people to leave the conference. That was really unfortunate, and it was not something we wanted to do, but we have something really fantastic this year we haven't had before, and as the organizers, we have a duty of care to make sure that this conference succeeds, that everyone's comfortable here, and they have a great time. So that wasn't fun. But that's what happened. So I'm sure there's bits and pieces of rumors going around and things like that, but we just had a responsibility to let you know that that's happened. I don't know what that's for, but... Good morning, freedom lovers! How was open day? Where is Pia? Where's that little voice in the dim dark regions of the audience? I don't think she's here at the moment. That's unfortunate. I think she's chasing after Jim Geddes. So what you'll have to do is give an enormous cheer for Pia's work on open day for the video so that when she watches it back, she can see how much you appreciate her in the dim, tinny speakers on my laptop. So give her a huge cheer. One, two, three. Okay, so you burnt some of my nostril hair. Thank you. Who went and had a look at all the cool stuff in Open Day? Everyone here? Rock! Who exhibited at Open Day? Thank you very much. We had a heck of a lot of good feedback. And it looks like that's another new ingredient for Linux Confe U. It's wonderful to have everyone here and be able to have, you know, the rock stars of the free software world showing off great stuff to family, friends, students, and so on. So thanks very much. Oh, yeah. So, Lindsay, if you could pop up here for a moment. Good morning, Lindsay. Everyone say hello to Lindsay. God, they're suckers, aren't they?
Indeed they are.
So come along. We have a prize to give away this morning, and we have a bit of code that Lindsay cooked up last week to work out who we're going to give the prize to. So do you want to do the honors?
Okay.
Apparently I didn't change the speed. Yeah. Oh, look at all these poor people listening to their names rolling by. That's got to suck. My name? What's my name doing in there? Pia's in there. We're going to have to roll this again if it's one of us. Clearly, we can't win anything. Sean, are you here? That's really unfortunate for Sean. Going once? Going twice? And so is my wife. They're going to have to suffer in their jocks again. Maybe we should ask, have you seen your name up there yet? No. Apparently we used this yesterday for the raffle at Open Day, and apparently two numbers came up in quick succession that were only three images away from each other. And there were claims from the crowd that it wasn't truly random. And somehow I wonder why software engineers would claim that that's not random. And sure? Rock and roll! Come on down. You want to give me a hug? We thanks the Intel, who have some sexy hardware for us. You have this beautiful Windows Vista Premium Ready PC. No, it's okay. Apparently, it's beautifully compatible with Linux. So, there you go. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good work.
There's more awesome, though, because it's so yummy smelling. Do we have a Chris Blizzard in the room? Ah! Right, okay. Who has come down with the LCA flu? A few of you. At least it's not the LCA norovirus this year. We've just been spreading the flu. I love you, man. So, Chris, if you could come up with your special device. The other one. The green one. Okay. And Andy, if you'd like to come up on stage, please.
So this is for you. Hopefully you can try and get Minix working on it. We'll be around to answer questions, because I'm sure you have a lot.
All right. Thank you. Thanks very much, Chris. There's an additional OLPC that we have, potentially for a member of the crowd who does not have such a esteemed background in operating system design, or maybe you do. But if we could get a paragraph of why you should have an OLPC and what awesome cool stuff you're going to hack on it to send to developers@laptop.org, you might want to CC it to 7contact@LCA. Go to the contact page of our website, CC7contact, but also send it to developers@laptop.org. We'll sort it out if it doesn't actually go there. But send one paragraph why you should go have an OLPC at this afternoon session and what awesome cool stuff you're going to hack on it or do with it. And Chris and Jim will figure out who's written the best thing. It's not a 25 words or less thing. So you don't have to say, I really, 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 really want an OLPC. That's not going to help you in this instance. Couple of minor things. Lost and found. There are a bunch of things in the Lost and Found box at the... We actually now have a Lost and Found room behind the registration desk. So if you've lost anything or found anything, please go there. Additionally, in Lost and Found, during the closing session today, the network in the pavilions unfortunately will be lost. But if you go back to your colleges, you will find network there. We're not completely killing the whole thing. Unfortunately, we just have to move out of the pavilions. Small announcements, Linux Chicks Blue Mountains meeting at morning tea. Please go and see Sarah at the registration desk if you're involved in that. MiniConf leaders, who ran MiniConfs? Yes. And Lug leaders, who's the leader of a Linux user group here in Australia? Hands. Okay. Please, could you... developersingular@laptop.org, not developers. If you want the OLPC, send it to developersingular, not plural. MiniConf and Lug leaders, please go to the green room, which is just outside the door here, at morning tea to have a little meeting with Donna. I'm told that you're all very much in trouble. And that's it from me this morning. One of the things that I have really enjoyed, and the 7 team have enjoyed greatly about being organizers, is that we get to choose our keynotes. The program review committee don't get to do that, so it's our privilege. And one of the best things is being able to choose keynotes that we think will be really interesting to the crowd and that the crowd will really desire, and keynotes that the crowd doesn't know they desire yet. And a certain part of that is an amount of education that we potentially think the crowd needs. So I'd like to introduce Kathy Sierra, today's keynote, to the stage. Kathy.
That was an interesting introduction. So what are you saying? God, the last time I taught in a room like, well, actually the last time I spoke in a room like this, I was teaching a class at UCLA, so I'm kind of compelled to give you homework or an exam or something. Okay, we're going to talk about how to create passionate users. And when I talk about passionate users, I don't mean happy customers. I don't mean satisfied users. I'm really talking about the same kind of passion that y'all might have for a hobby or a cause or something that you really, really like. So let's kind of get you in the mood for thinking about what passion is. It's a little hard to do at 9 o'clock in the morning. These are the domains that we looked at. Each of these has something to teach us about how to create passionate users. So in this little bit of time, we're going to do kind of a whirlwind tour of little bits and pieces that each of these things have to tell us about how to create passionate users. Any musicians in here? Okay, then you might appreciate this quote. This is the kind of passion that we're talking about. Digital photographers? I know there's a lot in here because I've already seen Flickr photos from this conference, then you might understand this quote. So that's the kind of feeling that we're going for. So I want you to just take a second and think about something that you're passionate about that has nothing to do with Linux. So there's got to be something else. So try to think about something that you're passionate about. And it could be something you were passionate about in the past. And here's the test, and this is also for everything else I'm going to talk about, to know if you're really passionate about something or if you were passionate about something. It's because you wanted to learn more about it. You wanted to get better. So again, this isn't just about, you know, product satisfaction. This is about really wanting to get better and kick ass at whatever that is. So take a second, and then in a second, I'm going to actually ask you to tell a couple people around you what that thing is that you were passionate about. And that's so you can hear what other people are passionate about. And then that will frame the rest of what we're going to talk about. So you got something? And Jeff tells me we can lock the doors and no one leaves until you've done this. So I'll give you about 30 seconds. Go ahead and tell a couple people around you something you're passionate about now or in the past, and I'll just wait. Okay, I'm going to stop you. That's pretty good for this early in the morning. Actually, mine's Icelandic horses. Okay. What weird things did you hear from someone else? Anything you didn't expect? Well, that's weird. Or okay, maybe for you guys. Okay, what else? Anything else?
Drag racing.
Drag racing? Okay. What else? Okay, good. I think you got the idea. So we have to figure out how to do it. These are all the reasons that we want to have passionate users. I think you can figure that out. But there's one more thing that's an actually, let me go back to this for a second. These are the things that are attributes of passionate users. So when we look at the characteristics of people who have a passion for something, and that's really what this whole project that I've been working on for quite a while is really about, reverse engineering passionate users. So this is how they behave, but there's one more characteristic of people who are passionate users, and we're going to use this to our advantage. And it's explained by this. When the Nano came out, people were waiting around the block at the Apple stores to buy one. And at the time the Nano came out, everybody already had an iPod. So, you know, who was waiting in line for these things? So people who are passionate about something, they're not rational. They think they are, but they're not. Now, this is what most people believe. This is what's true. The only difference is that women understand this, men are still in denial about that. Now, the bigger issue is it gets more significant when we're talking to geeks, because as geeks, we really believe that the rules of the brain don't apply to us, that we have rational, emotional brains, and that we have rational, logical brains, and that's ridiculous, and we'll find out why. So we're going to look at what are the attributes of passionate users, what are the characteristics of things that have passionate users, and if we can figure out what those things are, then maybe we can use those as a roadmap to try to drive passion. These things don't have to happen just by accident or by good luck. This is the main thing that we found, is that people are not passionate about something they suck at. So anything that we do to contribute to them sucking less at something, we're already starting to move up the curve a little bit. When people have a passion for something, it's a higher resolution experience. So remember earlier I said the way that you know you're passionate about something is because you want to get better, you want to learn more about it. So for example, people who appreciate jazz or classical music, they will hear things in the notes that the rest of us don't hear. This is a guy from Radiohead. So my daughter went to a festival, Radiohead Festival. We had some Radiohead CDs sitting around. You know, we listen to sometimes. She went to this festival, heard them live, came back, put the CDs on, and she swears that it's as if the CD, you know, was remastered with new information. She was able to hear more things than she could hear before. So for her, that was a high-resolution experience. This is a big rock in California. As far as I'm concerned, it's a big rock. What is this? Half Dome? So my partner, Bert Bates, is a rock climber. So when we went through California and went by that big rock, I just said, that's a big rock. He's seeing handholds and a bit depth that I don't actually see when I look at things like that, because I'm not a rock climber, don't want to be. Anyone see the movie Sideways? Or any wine snobs in here? So I think this is just bullshit, but anyway. But there are people who claim they have a higher resolution wine experience. On the other hand, there are people like Rusty. I'm in that category. This is the most important curve for us. It's really he who gets his users up that curve faster has a better chance of getting those users to become passionate. And all other things being equal, he who gets his users up past the suck threshold first will probably win. But a lot of times we then leave users in that big, vast middle ground where they're never going to upgrade. They have some level of competency. They don't suck anymore. Nobody wants to upgrade because they don't want to suck again. So we have to figure out how to really work at getting people through all these milestones that we're going to talk about today. Getting people to try something for the first time. Getting them to try it the second time, especially because the first time probably did suck. And then how to get past that first threshold, and then hopefully to keep going from there. So these are the kind of things that we're going to talk about. But that's our job, to get them up there. Now, this is the biggest problem that we have as technical people and software developers, is that we think everyone else is as thrilled with our tools as we are, but it's never about the tools. It's never about the software. It's always about what the tools let us do. So So when people are passionate, they might say they're passionate for a particular tool, but they're not. They want the tool to get the hell out of the way so they can use the tool to do the thing, the really cool thing they want to do. And so much of our effort on helping people get up the curve, we focus on helping them get up the curve on the tool. That's the wrong focus. They're not going to be passionate about the tool no matter what we do. So our effort on getting them up the curve has to be getting them up the curve on the thing they want to use the tool for. And that could profoundly change the way we do documentation. We'll talk about that in a second. So this is the Nikon Learning Center site. It's actually kind of hard to find. I bought a Nikon recently, a very expensive Nikon, and it came with a really bad manual. But when I go onto this site, it teaches me just enough about the camera and as much as it can about how to take better pictures. And in fact, when I saw this, I used to have just a point-and-shoot Nikon. When I got to this screen right here, I said, oh, God, that's so cool. I have to be able to do that. So for the photographers in here, what kind of control do you need to be able to take a picture like that with that smooth, flowy water? I need to be able to control shutter speed. So by putting up a little training tutorial, Nikon taught me why I needed to spend another $1,000 for a camera just to get that picture. But then this is their manual. So their manual has nothing to say about how to take a picture. It has everything to say about using the camera. One of the reasons I bought this camera is the D200 to be able to take high-speed shots of my horses. You can't figure out how to take high-speed shots from this manual. You have to read the entire thing and then sort of triangulate on all the different elements that you have to change in all the different settings. They could have just had one thing that said, oh, by the way, here's how to take action shots. So, you know, you're on your own. So they spend all this money on marketing, and then once you've actually paid your money, they treat you like this. So we need to think about how to get people to be better, because being better is a higher resolution experience, and that's where passion lives. So we have to figure out how to do that. So think for a minute about whatever it is that you make and ask yourself, what can we help our users kick ass at? What can we help our users be better at? Not how can they get better at our tool, not how can we do better documentation, but how can we help them be better at what they're using our tool to do? So, that sounds easy. Here's the first problem, the user's brain. We all have a legacy brain, so your brain has no idea that you're living in, this is 2007 now, has no idea that you're living now. It thinks that you're still living in a cave. It thinks you have a very different level of threat and motivation than you actually do. This is a huge problem. So when we put out information for our users, whether it's, you know, right down to the user interface, to our documentation, marketing, any communication we have with users, we're talking to their mind, that rational, logical mind they don't have. And we should be talking to the legacy brain because it's in charge. It's really running the show. So the brain has this crap filter. So I assume most of you have been in school at one time. So you understand this feeling. You're studying your textbook because you have an exam the next morning, and it's a really boring, dull class. Who has the name of a class they had to take in a computer science course that was really dull and boring? Okay, you have that picture in mind. So you're studying. You're really motivated to pass this test because you'll be kicked out of school, your parents will kill you, you'll lose your scholarship, whatever it might be. You have to pass the test. And even though it's a really dull book, you might still be really motivated by the topic. So your mind is very motivated and trying to pay attention. But you know how you sit there and you just read the same paragraph over and over? You can't stay awake. You can't stay focused on it no matter what you do. Because you're sitting there with this book and your mind is saying, I've got to do this, I've got to do this. And your brain is saying, this is so not life-threatening. There is nothing interesting here. So your brain is paying attention for pizza smells, you know, the sound of beer mugs, the hot girls on the third floor dorm, whatever it is. Your brain is scanning for something more interesting. So if the brain has this big crap filter, and actually they know this now, that there's been such an explosion of brain research, because now the technology like functional MRIs are so much more readily available to researchers, and there's been a lot more emphasis on research into Alzheimer's, that's given the rest of us a lot of great information on how to get into the brain. So one of the things they found out, this guy won a Nobel Prize for it a few years ago, is that there's a lot of brain chemistry, in fact, a huge amount of brain chemistry, devoted to making sure you don't remember. So there's this, in fact, they could give you a drug right now that would actually cause you to remember everything from the first exposure. But instead, you have these agents that are actually blocking you from remembering things because you'd go insane. So it'd be nice to just take it just for the test, though. So we have to figure out, if this is what we're fighting when we're trying to communicate with our users, and we're not going to be able to help them get better if they're dealing with this, if their brain is filtering everything out, we need to bust through the crap filter. So what breaks through the brain's crap filter? And this is what we need to look at for anything that we do when we want to reach someone. Well, if you were a legacy brain, what would you care about? Chemistry. If you feel something, that's one of the brain's cues, one of the most important cues. Hey, this is important. I don't know what it is. This person just felt something. Therefore, it was important. So you can imagine when people are reading your documentation, what are they feeling? It's probably not the kind of chemical that's turning the brain on. So if you're a legacy brain, you pay attention to things like weird things, things that are just a little bit novel, anything that's just a little bit... See that tiny little reaction? That's enough. That's enough to cause your brain to wake up again and say, oh, I'll pay attention. And we can't just do it once. Now watch where your eye goes. It just goes to the thing that is different from everything else. It's not that it's a purple duck. It's that it's purple in a sea of yellow ducks. Scary things, obviously, if you're a legacy brain. You would probably survive to pass on your genes if you knew that that was a bad thing. Spiders. Thrills, obvious, 80s. Our brains are tuned to pay attention to young, sweet, innocent things, or everyone in here who has kids understands you would leave your children out in the backyard for, like, days. See? Okay. This is about the eighth time I've showed this picture now, and everyone always goes, oh, over the puppy more than the baby. Think about that. Things that are fun or joyful. So joy to the brain, joy means, oh, you must be playing. All mammals play. It's how they survive and learn to survive when they're young. So the brain loves this. This is a turn on for the brain. It says you must be doing something good. So it pays attention. So any little feeling like that is enough to wake the brain up. So these things are not trivial. So many times people think things like, you know, cartoons and again, things that are actually funny, that's only one element of many that you can use. But a lot of times we look at stuff like that and say, well, you know, that's just kind of irrelevant fluff. No, it's not irrelevant fluff. It's the thing that caused your brain chemistry to surge and caused your brain to pay attention to the stuff that is not fluff. So these things do matter. Faces. There's so much brain energy devoted to processing faces. And you can imagine why. Our legacy brain, we needed to learn by being able to recognize that whatever that guy's looking at, I should look too. Whatever that guy's looking at, I should probably run the other way. And I definitely, anyone who didn't interpret that correctly probably didn't continue on. We recognize things as faces. Now, so those are things the brain does care about that can get past the crap filter. What are the things the brain does not care about? It doesn't care about just, you know, simple little cliche pictures that don't really have any strong meaning. If you don't know those two people, there's not much going on there. But look at this for a second. The brain does pay attention to this because the brain wants to know, what's the story? If there's something just a little bit off, and it's just a little bit, it makes the brain curious, that's intoxicating to the brain. It's got to know, it's got to figure out what is going on there. Anytime that something is not fully resolved, the brain wants to become engaged. And it's not even something that you're consciously in control of. So that doesn't mean you should just write really obscure documentation in ESET. Now, what the brain, other things the brain does not care about, tablet, PC, no, it doesn't care. It doesn't care about these ads that you see in every single computer company. One time, so I worked at Sun for quite a few years, and one time that some marketing people came in and said, we're just about to do a new photo shoot in the customer Java Education Center. Any last-minute tips? And I said, whatever you do, please don't have those pictures where people, happy people are pointing to the screen. So that's what they did. Anyway, the brain just doesn't care about that. The brain cares about this. And Jeff, I'm still getting over the hair thing. Jeff understands this. So again, brain doesn't care, brain cares. Brain doesn't care about code. Brain cares about that face. So a lot of times what we try to do when we're trying to teach someone, in my case, I write programming books. We try to pair code with something the brain cares about, try to make a link. So the brain says, I don't know what that code's about, but look at her face. I guess I better pay attention. The brain does not care about UML. But any software developer, which I reckon just about all of you are, would understand and get a visceral feeling from this. Something has gone terribly wrong with this design. So for example, this is a picture in our design patterns book. And we want you to feel that, how bad that decision is that led to this. So these are some of the techniques that we use. Another thing the brain really cares about, and this one, I love this one, is conversational language beats formal language by a significant amount. Subtle changes from formal language to just subtle changes like using the word you can lead to sometimes as much as a 50% improvement in retention and recall. So when these studies first came out, people were curious about, well, how could that possibly be? How could something that subtle make a difference? So they looked back to other studies, unrelated, but that they put together and said, maybe this is why. So they're not sure, but here's one of the theories, is that it's because when your brain is reading something that's conversational or listening to a lecture that's conversational, your brain thinks it's in a conversation. And your brain says, damn it, but my end, I got to pay attention. So anytime you can write with conversational language, you have a better chance of breaking through. And it's not that we don't all know that intuitively. But again, as geeks, a lot of times we're just not realizing that we should be talking to the brain, not the mind. So we have to keep focused on that no matter what we do. But all we did was get their attention. All we did now was just break through the crap filter. We just got our little toe in the brain door. We have a long way to go. So how do we get them through this phase? Past that suck threshold. That's a tricky one. Any snowboarders in here or skiers or any extreme sports? So why does anyone snowboard the second time? Because this is what the first time is like. For me, it was 2 days like that. So why would anyone ever go back? Well, there is a reason. That people do things that suck in the beginning. It's because there's a motivating picture. They have an idea of how cool this could be. There has to be some motivation that's powerful and compelling enough to overcome the suck part. So when people see this, or they hear their friends talk about it, or they watch the flying tomato in the Olympics, but they, you know, they think, okay, that could be fun. It's worth it. Or they think it's worth it. But there's another reason to go along with that. If all you had was just this picture, you might think, yeah, but I'll never get there. But skiing, like so many other things, and snowboarding, has these graduated levels. And this is how, of course, the runs are marked, things that you do are marked. So there's a path to getting there. There's a series of steps. So when we looked at things that people were willing to stick with through the suck phase, whether it's software or snowboarding or whatever it might be, we always found there was a compelling picture that someone had painted for them in some way, even if it's as simple as, God, wouldn't you love to be able to write this chapter or whatever it is, something that person would find compelling, and a series of steps to getting there, some sort of clear path so that they knew, okay, I don't know how I'm going to get there, but I'm going to trust that if I just take the first step on the green level and then the blue level, I'm eventually going to get there. So a lot of times we don't give our users any way to perceive that there's a path to coming up that curve. So these are the things that we need to have in place if we want to get people involved, whether it's actually using our software or getting involved in a project that you've created or a cause that you want people to get in with. Have you given them this picture, this path, and this easy step in? So think about what is the compelling picture, the clear path, and easy first step for some of these things. All those things need to be in place. And again, sometimes it's as easy as throwing up a couple bullet points that just make the right point. We're still just getting started. We're just getting people to take the first step and then the second step after we've broken through the brain's crap filter, so there's more to go. How do we keep them engaged? Especially if that period before they cross the suck threshold, if that's a long period of time, then we need to figure out how to engage them while they're in there. Once they get up to a certain level, of course, they're on their own, and they're going to be just fine. This book, I used to be a game developer at Virgin, and this book in my division was required reading. How many people have read Flow? Oh, man. Okay. You're still going on Amazon right now. Okay. This book is, if you absorbed what's in this book, and it's a really easy read, you don't even have to read the whole thing, you would understand, you know, there would be like a graduate course in how to keep people engaged and involved. Now, you all know the flow state because most of you are programmers. So the way that you know that you're in the flow state is you're writing code, and you don't realize what time it is. And all of a sudden you look at your watch or something happens to interrupt you or the phone rings and it's kind of a shock. And you look outside and you can't believe that it's dark. And you had no idea and you were sitting right next to the window. You were so involved that the rest of the world faded away. This is what keeps people engaged for longer and longer periods of time. Now, the reason that you were in that state is because you believed the whole time that you were just one compile away from success. As long as you mistakenly believed that, you kept at it. If you knew the truth, you would have gone home. But because you kept thinking, I'm just one compile away, I've almost got it. So there are two very important factors that have to be in balance, whether it's a game or any other kind of activity that someone gets engaged in. Working with a piece of software, doing art, doing a sport, whatever it is, there are two things that have to be in balance. And when those things are in balance, you have a great chance of getting someone in flow, and that's really the goal. So, what are these two things? I'll give you the first one. Knowledge and skill needs to be balanced against something else. So, for example, watching television, that is not a flow state. That actually is kind of a almost being hypnotized state, but it's not actually the flow state. Knowledge and skill have to be balanced against what? A challenge. So there has to be a challenge, and there's that kind of Goldilocks thing. It can't be too big of a challenge. It can't be too small of a challenge. It has to be just right for where you perceive you are. So we need to give people knowledge and skills, but we also need to make sure there's a challenge. Once that challenge ends and their knowledge and skill exceeds it, you know, no one continues to play tic-tac-toe, or people will play chess. So we have to think about how to get people knowledge and skills and challenge that they can progress with and grow with. But again, not the challenge should not be how to use the damn tool. The challenge has to be in how to do the most amazing, cool things with this tool, whatever they perceive as amazing. I mean, my kids don't think writing code is a very amazing thing, but I do. So let's look at cognitive seduction. These are things that turn the brain on. We adapted this from a game design book. It's called The Typology of Cognitive Pleasures. Here are some of the things that turn the brain on. in your product, or whatever it is that you're doing, or even if it's just trying to get people involved in your project, you're definitely going to have at least a few of these things, and you should exploit them. The sense of discovery is turns the brain on. Challenge, narrative, we've been learning some stories for forever. Self-expression, social framework, cognitive arousal, which basically means, you know, things like puzzles. Thrill, sensation, all of these things. Think about what aspect of the thing that you provide, what aspect can support some of these things, and figure out how to make that happen at a greater level. Now, you're in flow, you're in flow, you're in flow, the world drops away, you have no idea what's going on, which is great because you're so fully engaged. So what breaks flow? So if you think of flow as a state of enchantment, that your users are so involved in what they're doing that it's an alternate world. Now, we all tend to think about games, especially like fantasy role-playing games. Well, clearly, that's an alternate world. But there's a book, it's kind of an old book, called Computers as Theater, written by Brenda Laurel. In that book, she talks about how it doesn't matter what the software is. A spreadsheet, if you're involved enough, is an alternate world. It's an alternate world where, unless you're struggling with the frickin' menu and the interface, you're actually doing modeling, whatever it might be. So anything has the potential to be this alternate world. So what breaks flow is anything that pulls them out of reality. So you're watching a movie, and this comes up. That would break flow. That would seriously break flow. So anything that causes you to be jarred back to reality is probably bad. One of the best techniques is actually the horse training technique, the secret of horse training, which I think applies to usability brilliantly, which is just make the right things easy and the wrong things difficult to do. Simple thing to talk about, obviously challenging to implement, but this is really an important mantra for usability. All right, so we talked about how to keep them engaged. Well, maybe that got them through one session. How do we keep them motivated over a sustained period of time? So the next step is, again, nobody does this better than game developers. This is a design model that we use for almost everything, including our programming books, not just our software or games, which is we start with the motivating benefit, something that the person ideally finds compelling. Then there's the period of time where they're doing the do, whatever it is, reading the documentation, using the software, doing a tutorial, whatever it is. Then there's got to be some payoff. Now, the timing through that cycle matters greatly, but it also depends on where they are, how far up the curve they are. So we're going to talk about the granularity of trips through that spiral. A lot of times we find out people just sort of, oops, forgot the payoff. Now, what do games have for the payoff? Levels. So games are great because they have levels. And levels are really motivating. Any people study martial arts in here? Any kind? Okay, a lot. So I don't. So, of course, I thought this was ridiculous when I saw this, that people would pay to frame their belts. But I'm studying a horse training program, and what you get at the end is a piece of string. And I met the woman whose full-time job is to frame people's strings, and they pay a great deal of money for this. That's after they've paid the money to actually do the certification to get to that level. So levels can be very powerful. Now, this is called the Pirelli Natural Horsemanship, which actually has quite an Australian influence. I interviewed the guy who started this, Pat Pirelli. Horse training does not scale, so this guy is off the charts because he figured out, well, I can keep training horses, or I can train, you know, hundreds of thousands of people to train their own horses, which is what he did. He met with some people who were involved in martial arts programs, and they helped him figure out that you really need levels. You need some kind of a belt system, and it will make a huge difference, and it has. And most of what they've done has been trying to tweak what those levels are. If the first level is just too hard, people drop out. If it's too easy, they might not stick with it. So they're trying to figure out where the challenges are. So what are levels? What's the concept of a level? How can people achieve levels? They don't always have to be explicit levels with, you know, badges and titles and names, but there has to be some concept, something that lets people know I've achieved the next level. I'm in a new mode. I mean, even something like Photoshop has levels. If someone is using some of the color correction controls, that's a level that's different from the people like me who just choose filters. So we'll have to think about that. Here's some motivation milestones. So where you place your levels should be related to how far along they are. So obviously, the levels and the trips through that spiral should be closer together at the beginning and eventually get further and further spaced out. So think about, let's talk about this for a second. What do you get with a level? In a lot of games, you get new capabilities. And those new capabilities are often things that build into the next motivation. So if you're in a game and you hit a new level, you might get bigger guns. So if you have bigger guns, how can you stop now? Because now you have bigger guns, and of course, now there are bigger monsters, or whatever it is. So when we try to think about that spiral, we try to think of, well, that payoff, ideally, should be a very satisfying payoff that also starts to dangle the carrot for the next motivation. So even if it's programming, it's like, well, all right, now that you know how to do multiple threading, well, now you actually can write this chat server, whatever it is. And how can you stop now? So these are the kind of things that we think about. So think about your product or your cause or your project and think about what sort of superpowers are you giving to the people who participate, or to your users. What new capabilities do they get that matter to them? And again, if the answer is, well, now they're better and now they know where the menu items are, that's not right. So we got the challenge part, but we have to give them knowledge and skills. They have to be able to come up that curve to balance it out with flow. And learning is the key, of course, because learning helps give them that higher resolution experience. So when users don't read our documentation, who do we blame? And the F is the clue. The fact that we even say this. So we really have to think about our responsibility. This does not have to be a fancy thing. It just has to be something that talks to the brain. But that could profoundly change the approach that you use. Because again, a lot of times I look at people's documentation or my own when I'm not paying attention, and it's about the tool. When it should be framed in terms of, here's the amazing things that you get to do. Obviously, there's a place for reference documentation and a place for the learning documentation. A lot of times we just smush that all together, and we shouldn't. Now, who's going to provide all that help? Who's going to provide all that teaching to your users? Who's going to help your users come up the curve faster? Obviously, the community. So I just want to make a quick little stab at community. I started a community site quite a long time ago, I guess 97, called javaranch.com. And I no longer run it. I turned it over to someone else when I went to work for Sun. But today, shockingly, and through no credit to my own, it has 750,000 unique visitors a month. This is a huge, successful programmer, all-volunteer community. And we think it's because we have one very simple thing, but that we stick to. And it's kind of the opposite of the Slashdot model. Here's the terms of service. You have to just click that one button that says you agree to the terms. There's the term. That is it. Now, I always laugh because every time I talk about this, whether it's, you know, on my blog or in some group, people say, that can never work. Well, okay, it's been working. It's been working just fine. So the moderators are pretty much militant about enforcing that. Because obviously, where does your community go if people are afraid to ask questions? So especially with the newbies, we want them to be able to ask questions. We want them to feel comfortable. I started Java Ranch because I was trying to learn Java. In 96 and 97, there weren't a lot of resources. And there was comp.lang.java, the news group, and that was a very scary place for a woman. So I didn't like it there. And, you know, God forbid you ask a dumb question, and any question you asked was dumb. So Java Ranch was supposed to be a place where you could ask any question and no one was going to make you feel like an idiot. But what we found later is it's just as important to encourage people to answer questions. It doesn't do any good if you've got this active community asking questions. If, you know, you're stuck with just you answering them. We need to get these people helping each other as soon as possible. So at Java Ranch, especially in the beginner forums, we try really hard to encourage people to almost immediately start trying to answer questions. And that has turned out to be even more significant. So we teach them how to answer good questions. And we don't step on them when they do. We don't say, you know, you're an idiot. Obviously, they need to be corrected because we don't want to give the person who asked the question or anyone else wrong information. But we encourage people to take a chance. And I think you all know about teddy bear programming or rubber ducking, where you have a problem and you don't have anyone to discuss it with, so you set a rubber duck or a teddy bear. Look up rubber ducking on Wikipedia. And you sit the teddy bear or the rubber duck in front of you or your dog, and you start describing the problem, and something happens, and the solution comes to you as you're articulating it. So this is part of what we know, is that when someone tries to explain something, a different part of their brain switches on that engages them more deeply. So there's no dumb questions, but more importantly, there are no dumb answers. And that's a tricky one. Threadless is a great example of a community, just as a sideline, anytime you want to go there and see what they're doing. It's phenomenal. They're now, I think, the third largest T-shirt company in the United States, you know, started by basically a couple of, you know, slacker designers. But they have this amazing community. Okay, what do filmmakers know? User as hero. So we try to think of the user, whether in our case with our books it might be the learner or the software, the actual end user, they're on a hero's journey. And this is the modified hero's journey. So picture, you know, put Lord of the Rings in there. So helpful sidekicks and mentor, that's who we should be. But how often do you look at the provider, the company who made the software or whoever it is, and you think, no, they're not Gandalf. They're like the orcs. They're making it really, really difficult. So think about if a user's on a hero's journey, and they are, right? Someone wants to or needs to use a piece of software or wants to, okay, their life is normal, suddenly the call to action. Either their boss says, you must learn this now, or you have to be able to accomplish this, or they're motivated to do it, and now their life has changed. And now they've taken those first steps, and now things start to suck. Who's there to help them? Is it the community? Is it you? Are you encouraging the community to help them? Until they eventually return to a new normal. In the real hero's journey, when they return to a new normal, they bring the magic elixir back and help other people. So if you can get people far enough along that curve, suddenly you can just kick back because your community will do everything. I think I've probably answered two tech support. I shouldn't say this out loud. Being recorded. I've answered probably two tech support questions on my books in the last 2 years because people are discussing it already everywhere else, so I don't have to. So this, where that arrow is, this is the most important part that we don't often talk about, and it's the part where the user is changed in some way. So the question we ask all the people that we work with, whether they're authors, software developers, project leaders, nonprofits, how do you see the user changing as a result of this? How do you see them changing? What are they going to be able to, are they going to be able to think a little bit differently? Are they going to see things in a new way? Are they going to have this capability that's not just one more check mark, one more new skill, but actually a new way of thinking about whatever it is that they're doing? So we look at that. Today, oh, now it's 2007. Obviously, more and more people are looking for meaning. Here's an example of using an educational approach to providing meaning, the capital M. See if I can get this audio up. Do we have audio? So a lot of you probably seen this. That's what comes on the screen for a minute. If you go to this site, worldonfire.ca, pretty cool, huh? They have a whole list of where all the money went. So this is an example of kind of meeting with a capital M and actually providing education through this video, actually giving people a higher resolution experience. Not about the music, about something not really related to the music. Now, but it could be lowercase m. Doesn't have to be the big uppercase M meaning. If you help me do a little bit better at a game, meaningful to me. Just a little bit, if you help me have 5 minutes of better time at work, that's meaningful to me. Now, one of the things we know, as passionate users, is that they like to form tribes. I'd say there's one out there. And it might be a tribe based around something that people identify a part of themselves with. In your case, I think I can imagine a lot of the things that you all identify with that are very meaningful to you, and you identify part of who you are with this thing that you support, which brought you here in the first place. This is the most expensive thing I have in my house. I'm kind of embarrassed to say that, is this framed limited edition poster, because, you know, I like to fancy myself as someone who thinks different. So think about, what do you offer, whether it's, you know, a philosophy, an approach, a concept that people can identify with, that part of who they are can be related to that. Now, this was the Java 1 store a few years ago, and I went into the store, and I noticed that the t-shirts were gone off the shelf. So that was my t-shirt metric to say, well, all right, at that time, Java's still okay, because they're selling the t-shirts at the store. So one of the things that we have to think about is t-shirt-first development. Now, and this is not a trivial thing. This is not a marketing thing. This is because when people are in a tribe, I'm looking at the t-shirts a lot of y'all are wearing, I'm seeing penguins, and, you know. So when people are part of a tribe, they want to be able to let other people know they're part of that tribe, and that's what the t-shirt does. So get the t-shirt before you do anything else. And just in case you didn't know that they're geeks. So not only do people buy these things, they post pictures of themselves buying these things. Now, so we also have this idea called the nod. So the nod is when someone else recognizes you as being in the same tribe, for whatever it might be, whatever attribute that might be. You see someone with that, you know, with a particular t-shirt or slogan, they're in there. So I got an email from a guy who said, after I posted about this about a year ago, he said, I've been wearing this t-shirt with a really obscure literary reference, and the first woman who comes up and actually gets it, she will be, you know, my soulmate, the woman of my dreams. And it still hasn't happened. It's been like a lot of years. But he is hopeful. This is the back of my car, two things that matter to me, the Apple sticker and my Pirelli natural horsemanship sticker. This is someone who went too far. So, how can you help people demonstrate they're part of the tribe? And we're almost done. Finally, if you want them to be out there talking to other people, I mean, part of why we want passionate users is so they'll evangelize, we have to give them something to talk about, something interesting to talk about. So how many times do you encounter situations where you see people or you yourself have this feeling where you want to be the first person to tell someone some juicy little bit of news, whatever it might be? And it could be the tiniest thing. But there's this social currency that insider information lets us exchange. This actually is really is a pretty old slide now, so that 9,000 figure has definitely gone way up. So this is an Easter egg site. So I think probably a lot of you understand this one already. You can imagine what Google's going to come back with. Here's one on the map. If I type that, I get that. Cute. Now, who's this guy? Who's that band? Is this Coldplay? Pardon? That's Gwyneth Paltrow's husband. That's Chris Martin of Coldplay. He has the two bars on his hand. Now, he's very involved in Oxfam and Make Trade Fair. So he used to, on his hands when he'd go to a concert, he would have sharpied on his hands, maketradefair.com, the camera would always zoom in to his hands. It was a big deal. He stopped doing that, and he started putting the two bars. And he said the reason he put the two bars on is because so many people didn't know what it meant but wanted to know what it meant. So he started these kinds of conversations all over the internet. He said, that's a good thing. I want people to ask that question. People who ask the question become involved, and the person who answers the question gets points as well. Now, sometimes that happens accidentally. This is our design patterns book, and no, O'Reilly would not spring for our own cover model, so we used a model from a stock art collection that other people used, including, we didn't know it at the time, feminine hygiene products. And, of course, the book had been out about, you know, a day when everyone found out about that and couldn't wait to tell us. So we thought we'd fight back, and this was our first April Fool's joke. We didn't realize that people would take it seriously, and they were really upset. The kinds of comments that we got... We got, up until that time, that this was then, at the time, the most comments we'd ever gotten on a blog post. And, you know, one woman said, my husband's too upset. He can't write in to tell you how mad he is. And, you know, he went on Amazon and it broke his heart. And, you know, like the entire Scheme community was mad at us for not actually making this real, all 17 of them. And, So this was last year's April Fool joke, and we still were surprised that some people took that one seriously. So we get, okay, don't say it out loud if you know what it is. I think a lot of you do. Don't say it out loud. So the point is, you give people something to talk about. There's one Easter egg in that logo. There's actually 1.5, but I'll just count one. There's one Easter egg in that logo. It's been there all the time. If you don't know what it is, if you do know, don't say it. And if you don't know, you'll just have to figure it out. So insider information is social currency. And finally, where there is passion, there are people. Stories, founder stories, legends, gossip. What's this? A PDP something. So there's these guys. There's these guys. Every area where there's passion, there are people. Love them or hate them, there are people. Who's this guy? Bruce Lee. This one I didn't know, but actually I'm surprised a lot of people do. Rachel Ray. Someone in here actually cooks. Okay. Who's this? DJ Hubert, and you guys, got to work on your hip factor. Okay. Tiger, okay, better, yeah, that's true. I'm so relieved that you recognize that. Okay. So what happens is, you do want to promote yourself or someone, a user, some key figure. There needs to be people and stories and myths and legends. It needs to be out there, so you need to get people out there. But then, of course, this is what happens. You end up on the internet like this. So, and people start wondering who might play you in the movies. We actually couldn't find anyone to play Jeff. But he does have a couple of celebrities. He has a couple. Oh, no, you'll see. He does have some celebrity lookalikes, though. Nat. Now we got Jim Carrey. But, no, something else came up in the facial recognition software. This is actually pretty good. Chris Martin from Coldplay. Pretty good. This is my favorite one, actually. pretty good. Okay, the software had a little trouble with this one, but it did come up with Hugh Jackman. But wait, what does Hugh Jackman play? Yes, he plays Wolverine. So that's what happens if you put yourself out there. You have to be prepared for this sort of thing. So our brains are wired for stories. Do you give your users something to talk about? Do you give them something to identify with? Do you have people? Can you propagate these things? I'm going to skip through the, in the interest of time, we'll skip through the roadblocks. You can imagine what they are. But I do want to say something about this idea of flow. If you read this book, which you should, you'll find out that when people are in a state of flow, one compile away, they report that as being among the happiest times of their lives. And a big part of that is because the rest of the world does drop away. You're not stressed. You're not worried. You're not thinking about anything at all. You're so engaged. You're so in that zone. That's an amazing, wonderful, you know, life-enhancing thing, and we have the chance to bring that to people just by giving them a little better education in whatever it is that we're helping them do, by focusing on, instead of putting all our effort into helping them be better at the tool, helping them be better at the thing they want to do with the tool. Just these small things that we can do that add up to help people spend more time in flow improve their life. And I think we are all very fortunate to have a chance to do that all the time. And thank you so much for your time. Thank you, guys.
I don't have a microphone, so I'll have to speak loud. So on behalf of the LCA organizers, here's some boxes to you with LCA logo on them. Linux Confeu, not Linux.con foul. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Apparently we do have a microphone. So there's just one final thing we have to do before we break for morning tea. Jeremy, you ready to rock? We have a an invention by the Auslabs guys. It is in fact a virtual cake that you can eat. And Jeremy's going to explain it to us.
Well, our recipient today, he knows a bit about virtualization. Can you hold the cake there? So we've got a main cake with two guest cakes on top. Could you come up, Rusty?
Happy birthday to you.
I'm sorry to delight, but it's open source, right?
Can I go home now?
You want to take the cake? Yeah.
There you go.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
No problem.
Have a rocking day, and we'll see you back here in the afternoon for the closing ceremony.